Well, hey there, dear listeners. Here is part one of a two-part conversation I had with Chris Kavanaugh of the Decoding the Gurus podcast. The full chat was well over 2 hours long, so I thought with adding an intro and clips, it would become too much for a single episode, so I've split it into two. Both parts will be available on Patreon early, so if you'd like to get them both right away, you can find them via patreon.com/nicemangoes. And you'll be supporting the show, unlocking the bonus content, and so on. It's a win-win for everyone, except the IDW types, who absolutely hate it when you sign up for my Patreon. And they hate it even more when you leave the podcast a good review. So hey, why not go ahead and do that too? Anywho, in this first part, we spent a lot more time on the broader questions of decoding and calibrating generally the politics of the professional decoder that I had on. Like on the surface, Chris and I would probably vote the same and we're both critics of the IDW sphere, but our output is framed very differently. I think our motivations and goals with it are perhaps vastly different as well. That's what I was trying to dig into a little bit in this part. We touched on questions like whether the decoders themselves might ever become guru types and the essential litmus test question, is Sam Harris right wing? Which really helps clarify someone's personal Overton window in relation to the IDW, to my mind at least. We also talked about what Chris's own views on the Israel-Palestine situation are, as that topic came up in his recent chat with Harris too. So all that and more in part one of Decoding the Decoders. Part two was about hashing out more specific things and unpacking some stuff about their recent conversation with, my favorite guru of all time. But yeah, here's part one.
Welcome to the Polite Conversations podcast, where every episode is focused on civility, decorum, and good manners. And I'm your lovable, non-controversial host, Ina. If you know me, you know I definitely don't like to ruffle any feathers at all.
Welcome to episode 77. Today I've got a special guru decoder here with me. It's Chris Kavanaugh from Decoding the Gurus. How you doing, Chris?
Not bad for a Monday morning. Not bad.
Yeah, it's always so fun to think about how you're talking from the future, you know? Like, I'm pretty sure we went through this last time, too, but, like, I can't get over it. You're talking to me from...
Everything's different here.
The world is
it's
better.
It's all better. It's all resolved. There's no issues anymore. So you've got to look forward to.
Oh, if only. But, yeah, how have you guys been? The show is going quite well, I see.
Yeah. The podcast continues. People continue to say very strange and startling things. And unfortunately, our supply of gurus does not run thin. And the old ones continue to put out insane content. So yes, it's not, I don't think it's ever going to be the case that there aren't a whole bunch of online gurus, but maybe our will falter before then.
Do you think eventually you'll turn into online gurus? Have you turned into?
No, I don't think so because I don't have the level of confidence in my hot takes for that, but also I don't think that the level of self-regard, even with a healthy ego, that I could approach the level you need to do that. It's I think after covering, you know, Jordan Peterson and Brett Weinstein again recently, it's hard to see that as a potential future. Covering all the guru people does not make it an appealing career choice.
Well, it's a spectrum, right? And it's also something that can happen to you, like, inadvertently. You're not like a consciously self-describing guru, maybe?
Oh, yeah, sure. Like, almost none of them would regard themselves, with the exception of Jordan Peterson referring to himself as a prophet. I think the majority don't go that far in doing it, like endorsing it directly. And there is a spectrum, you know, there are people like closer to the extreme, and Jordan Peterson and Brett Weinstein are up at the tippy top. I think, you know, audience capture dynamics and all that are definitely a thing. But when I look at people like Constantine Kissin and their, you know, kind of hyper focus on growing their profile and audience, like kind of catering to what their audience wants, I don't think I have the correct personality to do that, and probably not the right political configuration to appeal. I think you have to go to the farther edges to build up, a partisan audience. I don't know that the moderate left has much of a marketplace for guru types. Maybe it does. Maybe Yuval Noah Harari shows that it does. But
he refers to himself as a centrist, no? Constantine Kissin?
Constantine Kissin does, yeah. Yes. Yuval Noah Harari, I don't know what he refers to himself. Probably a liberal, but...
Right.
Yeah, he's the... When I'm thinking of, you know, like kind of left moderate guru types, the main one I think of is Yuval Noah Harari. And yeah, that we just covered him in an episode, so he's like front and center of my mind. And yeah, that it's, you know, he's okay, but I don't think there's a huge marketplace for what he's selling.
I mean, he's pretty popular, but
In terms of sapiens, like the big narrative,
right. Yeah.
You know, the human Homo Deus or that kind of thing, that is popular. But in terms of his like essentially neoliberal globalism perspective, right? Like he's quite fond of the WEF and the UN, which is not a hugely popular position on the right or left in general. So. Yeah, he's a boogeyman for Alex Jones type and that kind of thing. But I don't think, Rutger Bregman or whatever would regard him as a particularly favorable figure either.
I don't even know who that is, but okay, I'll take your word.
Rutger Bregman's the guy, you know, that went on Tucker Carlson and made the point about him being a millionaire supported by billionaires. That Dutch economist guy was quite fun. And then went to Davos.
Okay.
And told off the people there for just patting themselves on the back and not doing much about tax evasion. So yeah, he's a good guy, I think, overall.
Okay. All right. So today, what I wanted to do was walk through with you some of that recent episode that you guys did with my best pal Sam Harris.
I did re-listen to the episode, but had managed to slightly put it out of my mind, but it's fresh from yesterday.
Great. And also I wanted to just talk about like some general things, like about how we talked about our differences and last time. So, firstly, I think that there's more of a difference between us now. Do you think that assessment is accurate?
Yeah, probably, though it depends on where where you're putting the stress. Like, maybe Are you talking about like in terms of assessment of Sam or more broadly?
More broadly. I mean, we'll talk about our assessment of Sam in a bit, but...
Yeah, I mean, quite possibly. Although I felt previously that you already had, you know, the view that there's... although we might share, you know, various views and points of criticism about Sam and whatnot, that, like, you know, that politically we are on the left, but different parts of the left and that kind of thing. So I didn't think that there was a huge distancing, but maybe that's just my, political spectrum understanding.
So I'm not, like, too horrifically woke for you or something? Is that what you're saying?
I mean it more that, like, I would have put you on the, progressive left the last time we spoke, and I would imagine you're still there.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, that isn't, I haven't perceived a massive shift in political opinion since then, but maybe that's speaking from my perspective.
Yeah, I don't think that my politics have changed too much. I think maybe in light of Israel and Gaza, I feel definitely more to the left of people that I thought were similar in politics to me.
Yeah, I think, well, in that sense, yeah, I definitely see, because I think there's been, in general, probably a more significant or more visible division between, like, progressive and, like, left moderates or centrist positions around the Israel-Gaza conflict. So in that regard, I think there's a general, like, broader division between progressives and liberals. Is liberals the right
terminology? So.
Yeah. Yeah. So that distinction, yeah.
I would also say that I'm probably more like lib than some of my left-leaning friends. So, I mean, I don't think our practical politics differs that greatly.
No. If I was in the U.S., I would vote for Biden.
Well, that says nothing now anymore, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I would imagine that, like, there are people on the progressive ring that wouldn't vote for Biden, but I've not viewed you as, like, that kind of person. I'm not saying that you would endorse everything, you know, that the Biden administration does or that kind of thing, but...
Right.
Yeah, so, like, in terms of voting, we'd probably 99% of the time end up voting for the same people.
Yeah, like, I would hate to vote for him, but I would do it.
yeah. And then, like, in the same way that I would vote for Corbyn, right, against a Tory government, although I wouldn't feel fantastic about it, but yeah.
Would you feel fantastic about voting for Biden right now?
Well, fantastic. Yeah, to be fair, I don't feel fantastic about many politicians, so that's probably an easy dodge. But I wouldn't. There aren't a huge amount of people that get me super enthusiastic. But Biden is not. I would have said I was enthusiastic about Obama's potential when he came in.
I was back then too.
I don't have that feeling about a Biden presidency. I think it's just going to be pretty much more of the same. But compared to Trump, that will be much preferable.
Right, right. So one thing I did want to ask last time we spoke, I know we left on the note of me saying, "Hey, Chris, maybe give some thought to, I would be happy if you give some thought to the idea that maybe Sam Harris is actually pretty right-wing." And you said, you'll think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So did you think about it?
Well, yeah. So I would say my position then was that I can see a bunch of things that, like, I think place Sam, you know, depending on where your political spectrum is, more on the left. But There are a bunch of areas, including the ones that you've highlighted very well on waking, not waking up, wait, what the I forgot the name of the...
Woking up,
yeah, that's it. I'll almost give you an unfair characterization as the same name. So, yeah, and that there are a bunch of areas in which Sam is charitably neocon, but less charitably much more closer to the far right. And I would say that since then, especially since the Gaza conflict broke out, that he has continued to emphasize more the parts of his like output which are more aligned with the, again, charitably the neocon right and less charitably like far right sympathies. So I still think that if it comes down to it, that he will almost, like in the same way, I think he's likely to vote for Biden, right, in the upcoming...
But you realize that means nothing, right?
I think to me it doesn't mean nothing in the sense that, like, I wish that many people would take that route. So, like, but I don't think it's the only thing that matters. Like, in the same way that when people are able to condemn Trump, like, that's a very low bar. So,
yes
not voting for Trump. I'm glad that anybody would do that. So, you know, if you only care about voting behavior, then I think it's reasonable to classify Sam as, like, on the left. But in terms of his output, yeah, I would put him more firmly in the neocon arena than he was previously. And I would also say that a good illustration of that very recently was this conversation with Rory Stewart, mm-hmm.
Who is an actual right-winger.
Yeah, and compared to him, Sam seemed like very, very far away from him, right? And Rory is moderate conservative, so... Yeah.
Yep. And I mean, I think I pointed out to you the same kind of dynamic between him and David Frum and a couple of other sort of never Trump right wingers, people who identify as right wing, but they are still to the left of Sam on several issues.
Yeah. And I would also say that, you know, in recently, when Sam has put out content that has focused on politics, he very often has on, like, your kind of David Frum or your Brett Stevens-style conservative. Mm-hmm. And there's very, very little gap in their point of view, right? Like, and as you know, on some occasions, the difference is that Sam is more strong than the conservative guy. So I would, like, think that Sam should notice that he politically aligns on a whole heap of issues much more closely with, like, the that wing of the right, and especially around Israel. Like, I know we'll get into it, but in the conversation that we had with him, his presentation of London and European politics is like it was a reflection of Douglas Murray.
Imagine if things were quite a bit worse in the U.S. with respect to the derangement of the left and the threat the real threat of Islamism subverting much of what I care about in American society, which is where we are in the U.K., honestly. When I saw those protests after October 7th, I thought, okay, London is ruined. London is ruined.
London is ruined.
Right. It's just that's just an awful situation that this is the number of people you can get out in support of atrocity. Right. If that were the situation in the U.S., I might find myself on stage with, you know, quasi theocratic Christians. Right. Who are like the last people I could find to see eye to eye with me on this particular subject. Right. The only reliable people in the United States for the longest time on this subject, and it may, to some degree, you know, to a first approximation, it's still true, are fundamentalist Christians. They're the only people who you don't have to burn endless amounts of gas trying to convince that jihadists actually believe in paradise.
But it was essentially that portrayal is the like kind of hard right portrayal, and he doesn't regard that as extreme,
right,
and regards like the Rory Stewart approach has been like way too moderate, way too compensatory or whatever for the Islamist conservatives. So yeah, I think that there's a very strong case to be made that in a lot of his output he is on the right.
But what, like, so has your position changed in the past 2 years since we've last spoken at all, or are we still like in the same spot there, where you agree there's a very strong case to be made, but you want to cling real hard to the fact that he's somehow still on the left?
No, I would place Sam for the majority of his policies that he's emphasized, like in the past, you know, 12 to 18 months or whatever, like more firmly towards neocon, like right. And so my contention is just, it depends on what you're like, how you're classifying people. So if it was by voting behavior, there's a whole bunch of people that, you know, vote left, but their positions on a whole heap of issues align with the right. But I would have no issue with, like, I would say to Sam as well that, like, you know, you align with a whole, like essentially with neocon positions, especially on foreign policy stuff. So I guess that I would say I think he's been more direct in some of the recent conversations with highlighting the distinction from the moderate right. Like,
I mean, was he not direct enough when he was doing the great replacement stuff, or praising Tommy Robinson?
Yeah. So in the same way, right, it's like, but in those occasions, it's usually been in the context of him talking to someone who is like in agreement, you know, like a Douglas Murray or a Majid Nawaz or mm-hmm. whatever. So what didn't happen so much was that you had a moderate right-wing person who is saying, no, that is extreme. Like, those figures are extreme, though. And then Sam kind of responding that, well, no, they're not, or they're getting things right. And I know he has said things like that in the past, but I feel like he's doing it more directly, or in a lot more of his content. Like, I feel that people must have noticed it more than previously. Like, the especially most recently with the Rory Stewart thing, but
and Israel, you
know, yeah, and Israel, like in response to Israel. But I mean, as you would know as well, there was some article, or maybe it was a podcast that he released a couple of years before, where he talked about Israel.
Yeah, similar points.
Yeah, and it was very similar.
Yeah,
in the way. So it's not like his position has like dramatically shifted, but it's just he wasn't really talking very much about Israel?
No, but it's in the face of the actions that are happening now that are so much more intensified than anything else in the past, and to use those kinds of apologetics,
yes,
that he would not use for any other country. Yeah. It's appalling to me, but it's also very stupid and silly, because it's not rational at all. Like, some of the things that he's saying, like, it's very childish insistence on something that's clearly not supported by fact.
Yeah, and he himself has repeatedly stated that he's basically exactly aligned with Douglas Murray on this. And Douglas Murray, by I would say by all measures, has revealed himself to be, you know, I mean, he already revealed this before, but if there was any doubt, he's extremely polemical and he's essentially a propagandist for Israel. So if you cannot spot that Douglas Murray is, one, extreme on Israel, and two, like sympathetic to the far right in Europe, then yes, I think your politics are askew and naive. And if you're very, very aligned with Douglas Murray, then your politics are right wing.
right. So you're saying that you've changed your view in the past couple of years? Like, I'm just trying to get a clear, simple, boiled down.
So I mean, I think I probably would say that Sam's, like, my view of him hasn't dramatically changed. If you'd asked me before if I felt that Sam was, like, sympathetic to Tommy Robinson and Douglas Murray and whatnot, I would say yes. But I would still have described him as somebody that overall, like, you know, taking all considerations and what his output is about and whatnot, that was on the left side. And now I would say, with his output over the past couple of years since we last spoke, that he's still likely to vote left, but his output is much more towards, like, moderate conservatism. So that's, like, my view on him kind of puts him in the same ballpark, but nothing that he's done is that surprising to me. So it isn't like my view has dramatically shifted, except I would say I continue to be surprised by how readily he accepts various narratives about, like, yeah, far right points of view about, like, the whole section, the conversation I had with him about London, or his position on Israel, because there's very, very little nuance there, right? It's like a very partisan perspective. So I would say that I was, like, somewhat surprised in the extent to which he will often say things more extreme than I anticipate that he is wanting to say. So in that respect, he did shift my point of view, because I would have thought that he might hold some such views, but that he wouldn't state it so directly.
You mean not just, like, come out pro-ethnic cleansing?
Yes. For example, that, yeah.
A demographic change where the entire Arab population of Gaza is relocated to a different country, and that country is then subsumed into part of Israel, that would be, like, genocide, right? At least cultural
genocide. No, that's not genocide. No. Genocide has a specific meaning.
Okay, genocide, okay, at very least, then, it is a forced relocation.
You mean ethnic cleansing. You mean ethnic cleansing, right? Which is a phrase that's often used along with genocide, and they're worlds apart with respect to their moral implications. I mean, history is just full of ethnic cleansing, which means people moving, right? People who can't get along wind up moving apart, right? That happens a hell of a lot, and it's, you know, it can be awful in terms of, you know, when done at the point of a sword, which happened under Islam again and again and again. I mean, nobody's losing sleep over the Jews that got run out of Syria and Yemen and Iraq and Egypt and Morocco and all after 1948, right? Like, no one's talking about their right of return. You know, what happened to their homes? The UN's not worrying about that, right? And yet everyone is worried about the Palestinians as this perpetual refugee population. What about all the people who left Syria in 2015 and went to Sweden, right? Okay, they've been. Do they have perpetual refugee status, or are they just now in Sweden?
So, Sam, just to clarify, so you are saying that, like, ethnic cleansing of the Gaza Strait isn't extreme position? 2 million people.
It's totally extreme. It is totally extreme in that. It's a non-starter. I mean, no one in the Palestinian world wants that, right? And the Arab, if you look at the Arab states' contribution to the status quo over the last 50 years, it has been very deliberately to hold the Palestinians in perpetual refugee status, so as to put the existence of Israel in question perpetually.
And I mean, he has done things like that before. In the previous conversation that we had, he talked about the Jews' potential responsibility for the Holocaust, right? So it's not like he doesn't say things like that. But in that case,
I have written that the Jews are in part responsible for the Holocaust. How tribal is that? Now, that's part of my denigration of belief of faith-based religion. It's like if the Jews defining themselves as Jews for 2,000 years, insisting upon living insular lives among communities that believe antithetical things about God and thinking that it's important to marry within their community because of, you know, the profundity of their religious beliefs and their unique covenant with God, all of that divisive bullshit is part of the backdrop that gave us the, you know, centuries of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust. So yeah, I'm someone who has made Judaism itself somewhat culpable in giving us the Holocaust. Now that, what am I, a neo-Nazi? What's my tribe?
Even in that, that felt more like a little bit of an attempt to, I don't know, edgily express how non-tribal you are, right? But saying that ethnic cleansing isn't extreme is, it's not like that. It's more kind of slightly horrifying. I don't know. It doesn't, that seems like, especially in the face of like an ongoing situation with starvation and, you know, mass deaths and whatnot, to be a rather callous thing to say publicly.
Mm. Yeah. So what is your position on what is going on? Just because I think it will be easier than to go through those comments that Sam made, just to know your view on it.
On the conflict in Gaza?
Yeah.
So, I mean, my view on it is that the events in October 7th, right, that was a horrifying massacre and tragedy, and the killing the civilians and the taking of hostages, terribleness, was going to lead to a, like, because it, anything like that previously has led to a very disproportionate response in terms of the amount of lives lost, right? The Israeli military response. So that felt like an inevitability after that happened. But even then, the scale of the military campaign and the humanitarian crisis that it's caused is, I think, shocking. And there's just horrifying images and stories and the general like suffering that is going on there at the minute seems undeniable. And in general, I think that insofar as I have like a position on it, the position is that the, you know, Western governments and other governments should be calling to like to stop the conflict and to allow humanitarian aid to go through. And yes, there are obvious issues about the like Hamas, the leadership. And in just in general, like, you know, the right-wing government in Israel as well, that I don't know how you resolve all of that, but I...
Oh, no, I'm not asking you to come up with a solution right now. Yeah. That would not be fair.
That's good. But yeah, so the broad thing is that I think there's an undeniable, horrific humanitarian crisis and that effort should be made to, like, focus attention on that and that...
And would you classify it as any particular thing?
Oh, you mean like a genocide? So, yeah, I in terms of like the whether it meets the technical definitions of a genocide, like in line with the UN Criminal Court or whatever, I don't know, because I don't know all of the characteristics required to like meet that, and it'll take a whole bunch of years, right? But I feel like even if it doesn't meet the technical definitions of a genocide, it nonetheless is a massive humanitarian crisis with a whole bunch of civilians being killed. So if it ends up not being officially recognized as that, it doesn't make the suffering any less. So I think that the general stance should be that, you know, to try and get the conflict and the military campaign to stop so that civilians can be helped. So, yeah.
Could you comfortably use the word ethnic cleansing for it?
Yeah. So in terms of the military campaign, in Israel's military seems, I'm not well versed about it, but it definitely seems that some people and high ranking people within the military would like the solution to be that Gazans
final
move. Well, that it, at least there is a forced migration, right? Mm-hmm. Or that the area is abandoned, like Sam mentioned on the podcast. So insofar as that is the agenda, that would be what I understand ethnic cleansing to be.
So you do see that as them plainly stating it on a daily basis, though, right? You see that?
I only see I've seen various statements by high-ranking officials which would fall in line with that, and I've seen statements which are more moderate and presenting it as that.
Yeah, but the existence of more moderate statements does not cancel out the existence of the high-ranking officials, military officials, soldiers, all plainly stating what their motivations are, and them holding conferences about what they're going to do with the land.
I don't know the Israeli military, in terms of what they're, I don't think, to some extent, I don't know who does know what the long-term goal is. I think the general thing is that people are, including maybe even the U.S. to some extent now, saying that they don't have a plan, right, about what they're hoping to achieve or not.
No, but I'm not saying ethnic cleansing as a written down, today I will be ethnic cleansing and that is my goal for this. No, I mean as we see it develop, as we see it come out of the mouths of people that are in power, not a clearly stated goal.
Yeah, so I think within the Israeli leadership, there's going to be people who definitely are have an ethnic cleansing kind of goal, the people that would support the growth of settlements, right? And as
including Netanyahu, the guy on top.
Oh, yeah. So I am. That wouldn't surprise me. but I'm thinking more about the far right parties that support him and the orthodox sects, right, that mm-hmm. are part of his coalition. So I absolutely think that would be their overall agenda. But I suspect that there would be other parts of the cabinet that would want there to be negotiated settlement where there is a regime change or there's some I don't know, some.
So agreement. If someone in some corner of the government wants that, do you think that overrides in any way what the majority of people were hearing say loud and clear?
No, video? I don't know the, as far, Israeli politics is not a specialty of mine, but
appalled. That's probably clear. How could you not?
But
we're all living in the same world right now. It's not a specialty of mine, too. Trust me, I've learned so much, just since October 7th.
Right, but my understanding would be, that Netanyahu has came out with various statements, strongly saying there won't be a two-state solution, right? Which mm-hmm. would, then what kind of solution are they hoping for?
And also, if you just look at the Likud charter. And
yeah. So, but in that case, if there, my understanding is that there are people within the Israeli government, or maybe it's the opposition, that like that do want that, like that that.
But are you saying for it to be an ethnic cleansing, for you to recognize it as like an ethnic cleansing happening right now, you need like everyone in the government to be on the same page?
No, but I mean in terms of like what the overall goal is, because like, so say for example that the conflict ends and there's a negotiated like truce, right, and it involves some form of regime change, or it involves some like, I don't know, whatever negotiation there is, would that mean that your assessment would change about what the goal was, that you think Israel then has completely reversed its policy, or that that was part of their potential goal? Because I view it like that that could definitely happen, right? That they there could be a like pressure from international groups.
Yeah, but just because they don't carry out the ethnic cleansing fully, it doesn't mean that they aren't trying to right now.
Yes. So I, but in that case, like, do you think that there is no part of the like Israeli government that would want a negotiated settlement? Like the majority of it just wants absolutely Gaza like completely depopulated in whatever form, and that they
that won't. Is pretty much all I've seen. And if there are some corners that are infighting or whatever, then I mean I'm sure it can it could be, but what are the clips from official after official after official that we're seeing, very vocal people on their TVs, their newscasters, their game show hosts, their soldiers on their TikToks. It's just because there might be soldiers that are saying that they don't like to do this, it doesn't mean that I don't count all the soldiers that are happily posing while blowing things up, you know?
Yeah, so I guess that, like, I would say, I would be perfectly fine saying that there are a whole bunch of people within the military and Israeli government that have, like, an ethnic cleansing goal. And
so you just need to see where it ends up in order to say that it is.
No, no. So I can say that. I can even, like, you know, say that there there could be a campaign that were that is the like the military intention, right, to try and make that like the outcome at the end, and okay. There were people stating that directly. Like the only hesitation that I have is that the like the goal of all the people in the government and the
But why does that have to be the goal of all the people in the government?
So, because if this military, if their military campaign can end without any of that being achieved and not being acceptable, that seems like...
But it's already being achieved.
Yeah, but I mean, it isn't achieved in the sense that there's still... the Gaza population is still in Gaza, right? Like they're under incredible conditions.
But they're all displaced. Their houses are uninhabitable. Their whole areas are uninhabitable, and they say they will be for decades.
Yeah, but the which is horrifying, and the you know removing the civil infrastructure is going to have a whole bunch of long term consequences. But the point is that the people haven't left, right? And they're not as far...
Well, so I think it's like over 35,000 now, the death toll. And that's very conservative because they don't really have an infrastructure to count these things effectively. And I think they say that it's 70,000 more that are injured. Mm. And the entire population is at risk for starvation. I was just looking some stuff up for another episode. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah, it's the fastest decline in a population status ever recorded, according to the Medical Aid for Palestine. the biggest cohort of pediatric amputees in history. You know, they're doing bouncy castles outside where they're blocking the aid. It's like family picnics. Mm. More journalists were killed in the first month of conflict than any other conflict since the CPJ, Center for Protecting Journalists, I think, first started collecting statistics. And if you want to see a comparison, I think it's like over 110 journalists now. 63 journalists were killed in the Vietnam War, 69 killed in World War II. Yeah, it's like unprecedented in a lot of ways. Over 13,000 children killed. That's only the ones we can count. So it's like roughly 100,000 people just injured and murdered. And if you talk about how small the population, the proportion that is, it's massive.
Yeah. So in that respect, then, like, do you anticipate at the end of the campaign that the population of Gaza will not be there? That they'll have been relocated to Egypt, or, you know, decimated to the point that it's just uninhabitable? Is that?
I don't know. I honestly can't say. I mean, I'm shocked at what the world is letting Israel do. It's unprecedented in modern times to such a great degree that I don't know how much more they will let them do. And it's shaken really my faith in all the Western countries, because I grew up, as you might know, in Saudi Arabia, in Pakistan. I didn't grow up in Pakistan, but I lived there. And to me, those were the worst examples of being so fucked on human rights, right? Like, I just couldn't imagine it being worse than that. And
yeah, because my perception, and again, this is just my perception for what it's worth, is that the Israel is going to continue its campaign until international pushback makes it such that it has to stop, and it at some point will stop, and then there will be negotiations and rebuilding, and they will have generated a massive level of support and sympathy for Hamas or any organization basically that, you know, promises to retaliate against Israel, and then that the things will continue from there. Like, I see it unlikely that the entire Gazan population will be relocated, and the
It doesn't all have to be relocated.
No, but so in that respect, like, the Western powers, like, accepting a whole, you know, the entire military campaign that's running now, it doesn't surprise me, because that's like the history of the Middle East involves a whole bunch of things like that, and the conflict in Syria saw horrific violence as well, and the, like, Western powers refusing to do things or doing certain things, some things counterproductive, some things not. But I mean, the level of casualties and suffering that the international community is prepared to accept.
But this is at a much faster rate than we've seen in modern times.
Yeah. And and Israel is eroding support, I think, more than it ever previously has, at least in recent years, right? Like, I believe that the U.S. has even, for like the first time in recent weeks, right, said that it won't support a military intervention.
Well, it keeps saying these kinds of things. It still hands them bombs on from the other side. Like,
yes. So you're right that it is just symbolic. But even the fact that that is being said is a change in the the atmosphere around it. So that's where I see things headed, and that's not good. It's not good for like anyone, and it's obviously terrible for all the civilians that are going to be suffering in Gaza currently and for generations afterwards, right, because of the damage to civilian infrastructure and just the sheer fact of like people dying and being injured. That doesn't go away when there's like a peace treaty signed. So yeah, I mean, that all of those things seem to me to be likely to happen and are horrific. So I've no issue like condemning them. I do.
But you don't want to classify this as, I just want to keep it simple.
Mm.
So yes or no, would you classify this as a genocide?
Yes
or no?
I can't answer yes or no, because it depends on what, it depends on what definition people use. So like in terms of, like, so say, for example, it doesn't, the court case goes through and it doesn't end up meeting the technical definitions of a genocide, but there's hundreds of thousands of more people have died, then I don't think it matters that it isn't technically meeting.
No, I'm not worried about whether the court will classify it or not, because the way I see it, either way, I don't think it matters, because yeah. It feels like nothing matters. So
that to me is a kind of like, if by genocide you mean that a whole bunch of civilians have been killed and that there are elements of a government that are intending to, or would like at least to completely remove a group from an area, right, and resettle it with their people.
So I'm just looking at the Convention on the Prevention of Genocide, and here's the first thing it says. Any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. So the acts are killing members of the group and then causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Yeah, so that's it.
Yeah, so like the reason I said it depends is like if you use a broad definition of genocide that you don't need all of those specific elements, but any component therein applies, then yes, there's no issue.
Is there anything that stood out to you as not happening currently?
Of those things, I don't know which ones are happening about like children being relocated or that kind of thing. But it doesn't mean that it couldn't happen, because I don't know about it. But I think in general,
though, there are some stories of like children going missing and soldiers having taken them, and then those stories vanish.
So, I mean, all of those kind of things, I don't think anything that important would hinge on it, right? So, like, my general answer would be, if there's a broad definition, then it's likely to fall under that. And I would say yes, like, under those conditions. And if it's, like, a very more technical legal definition, then I don't know. Because
no, but this is the definition, the Genocide Convention. This is the one Sam read out on his podcast. And so, I mean, he's certainly not going to go find some ultra easy definition, right?
Yeah.
But he skipped over the part where it says in whole or in part. And he keeps arguing that in whole, if they wanted to do a genocide, they could easily do a genocide, but because not every single Palestinian is killed, that means they're not doing a genocide.
Yeah, so I don't have any hesitation like that, because I mean, you could put 30,000 people into a stadium and wipe them out because of their ethnicity, right? And they are the only, I mean, they don't even need to be the only people, but they could be a component of an ethnic group. And I think that is a genocidal act, right?
You don't need to kill an entire people off. Like, I mean, Nazis then failed because they did not kill off every single Jewish person on Earth or even around them.
Yeah, so, you know, I think an example that speaks to this is, you know, the Srebrenica massacre.
Yes, I was going to say.
There you only have 8,000 or so people.
Yeah, something like that.
But there, I think that's an example of the kind of thing I mean, because, like, famously, Chomsky didn't want to refer to that as a genocide, right? Because he
not
said
my it, hero Chomsky. No,
no. But I mean, in his argument, it was because it's trivialized. It's like extending the definition too broadly, right? To encompass. Mm. But he did want to refer to.
You know, another person who has been a pedant about the Srebrenica massacre, genocide, ethnic cleansing, is our pal Sam Harris.
Okay, he also refused the, so yeah, in that case, like, you know, I have no issue with acknowledging again that it's like a genocidal act, even though it's a, you know, relatively small amount of people in terms of, like, you know, comparisons to the Holocaust or something like that. So I don't think it matters that all of the like Sam or indeed Destiny recently made the argument as well that, like, if you dropped a nuclear bomb and it killed 2 million Palestinians, that wouldn't be genocide because, you know, there's plenty of people still alive in the West Bank. And I think that's
what a smart guy.
Yeah, and I think that's obviously wrong, right? Like, so wrong in the sense of unethical, but also wrong in that that would be a genocidal act to drop a nuclear bomb on like Gaza. So yeah, I it's my position on it is that I don't have any hesitation depending on what definition you're using. And
well, you heard the one I'm using, so
yeah,
according to that's the one Sam is using as well.
Yeah, well, Sam isn't, right? Because he doesn't want to use the in part definition.
Well, yeah, that's the one he's read out and said it doesn't meet it because it's not meeting the all of them part. But yeah, he doesn't actually focus on the other words in it.
Yeah, but in terms of, like, you know,
So is Israel doing a genocide? Yes or no?
So the answer is the same. It depends on the definition.
Oh,
but
God.
Yes, according to, like, the broader definitions, yes, there are acts that I think fall under genocide, and under the more, like, restrictive ones, I don't know, is the answer. I don't know enough about happened or been documented or not to like say with confidence either way. But
can we say plausible genocide?
Yeah, I would say that, like, there's definitely a case to, like, the reason the International Criminal Court is looking at it is because there is a case. So
not because because everyone's anti-Semitic?
No, because, like, there wouldn't be that many. Wasn't it like 15 of 17 judges or something? Like, I don't think.
Oh, you'd be surprised what people argue. But yeah, I mean, everyone's anti-Semitic these days, apparently. Biden is Hamas.
Yes, setting that aside, no, I don't think it's anti-Semitic for there to be a, like, court. And I don't think the judges all decided that because they are, like, anti-Semitic. It seems deeply...
Careful there. It looks like you might have a few accusations of anti-Semitism coming your way.
Well, yeah, that would be... I think it would be hard to justify. Like, I haven't read the whole court procedure, but, like, the judges, aren't they from... I mean, they're not... They're all from a whole bunch of different countries.
Yeah.
So I defer to the relevant expertise in human rights.
All right. Okay, so we've agreed to call it a plausible genocide, or are we still going to say depending?
Oh, yeah, there's no, in terms of like, there's a case to be heard, and absolutely.
Okay. All right. Yeah, so this episode of yours with Sam, let's see, there was a lot going on there. You guys started off talking about, was it the lab leak theory?
Yeah.
And Sam, like, so weird. He was just saying that he didn't have a chance to listen to your episode on it, and that's why he didn't know enough or something. Like he's like, I didn't have a time machine.
Yeah,
that's, it's just such a strange justification.
I think he wanted to say that we raised points that he would not have known about in advance. So, like, in the narrow sense, I think his defense was, you wanted me to ask questions, but I didn't know the questions you wanted me to ask until after I heard your podcast. But the more general point, it wasn't specifically like the questions that we suggested that he ask. It's just that it was basic research would have got you a whole bunch of the, criticisms of Matt Ridley and Alina Chan's presentation, and that you could have at very least just kind of pushed back a bit. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, in the podcast that we recorded, we took all of the questions that Sam raised on the episode that they did with Alina and Matt, and we put them to the experts, and they were happy to answer it. So, you know, it wasn't as if that was something that's beyond the ken of anyone else to work out what to do. There's Alina and Matt says, here's these questions. Sam agrees these are important questions. So why not just ask some of the like relevant experts? Because as we highlighted, it's the same thing as, you know, a whole bunch of people raise questions about vaccines and their safety and the side effects. And they can be legitimate questions, but what you should then do is check with relevant experts before you assume that they are, presented accurately and that kind of thing. And Sam gets that with vaccines, but he didn't seem to get it with lab leak.
Does he, though, fully? Because as time has passed and we're not in the full, peak of COVID, I feel like his vaccine views have kind of turned into vaccine centrism. I believe, yes, I heard him tell someone that he wouldn't get another booster, and
that is
masking
true.
Wasn't necessarily a good idea. Masking kids, maybe. I think it was with Bill Maher, actually, if I'm not mistaken. Even worse, because Bill Maher is an anti-vaxxer. So.
He is. Not just an anti-vaxxer. He's also unsure if germs cause diseases. But yes, he's very bad. And I do agree, actually, that Sam, like a lot of people in the heterodox sphere, have like kind of ended up both siding things a little bit. And I think that in some respect, my my bar is extremely low because
it was low to start off with, Chris.
Yeah, if you are not actively promoting that vaccines are killing millions of people.
Okay. I feel like you have dug a hole and then shoved the bar in there now.
Yeah, I genuinely, this is true, but this is very hard for a lot of people in the heterodox sphere to overcome that bar. So, you know, like, I mean, I'm sure you saw recently the clip of Jordan Peterson talking about vaccines,
yes,
with Destiny.
Where he makes Destiny look like a decent, intelligent person,
yeah,
which,
no.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so in that respect, right, that is, but Jordan Peterson actually is not that extreme in amongst those, you know, that whole sphere. What he said.
Well, because anti-vax wasn't his main grift. His main grift is something else.
Yes, yeah. So, if that is a baseline, or at least, you know, that is somewhere in the realm considered reasonable. Like, Sam is nowhere near that, but he is the kind of person, like, for example, he had a conversation with Jordan Peterson a couple of weeks before Destiny, and none of the stuff came up there, right, about the disagreement with vaccines. And that in part seems to be because, well, one point is that Jordan actually did move the conversation off contentious things a couple of times, but the other thing is that I don't think Sam knows anything about Jordan.
How long are you going to let that
slide? No, but what I mean there is, I actually think it's I think Sam doesn't do, like, he deliberately doesn't.
It is willful, exactly.
Yeah.
Because he cannot. If he knows, then he cannot justify it. So it's easier to continue saying, I don't know enough about what so-and-so, my best friend, is saying. Also, listen to their podcast. Also,
yes, Douglas Murray.
Yes, Douglas Murray is the sanest voice on Islam and jihadism. No, actually, those are the topics he's unhinged on.
Yes, but, when you spoke to Sam, was it like 2016 or 2018 or sometime around then?
Yeah, 2016.
Yeah. He said the same thing whenever he raised the issues about Gadshad and Sam, and Douglas Murray and Dave Rubin.
Yeah.
And he's still saying it now. Yeah.
Still hasn't had a chance to look anything up about these types, yet still is associating with people like Douglas Murray happily. And the Orban thing, you know, you brought it up with him just recently, but I have heard, I think it was Josh Zepps on his very IDWS podcast, bring it up with Sam. And Sam was like, I don't know enough about that. And Josh was at that moment sounding concerned, perhaps because it was in relation to Orban being anti-Semitic. But, I mean, Josh has since reverted and is now touring with fucking Douglas Murray. So, I mean, these people are just, they're not honest, good faith actors. They are not bothered by associations with extremists. Yet they pretend that they would have those kinds of lines. And I think that pisses me off more than actually the act of associating with an extremist. It's the pretending that you have to do around it. Just be honest.
Raise one potential counterpoint to that, though, which I think is possible. And I wouldn't have thought it was possible until directly interacting on a couple of occasions with Sam and others, that whenever, like, you or I would say, you know, I haven't looked into that, and you would be, you know, especially if it was a topic that you had talked about repeatedly over years, right? Mm. It would be insane, right? You just be like, well, but you didn't spend one evening, like, you know, just...
Or
just
your friend, checking. Not just the topics.
Yeah, or your friend, completely, completely correct. But I get the impression with a bunch of people, and Sam included, that their primary interest is their opinion, their perspective, in a way that is... not.
Yeah, but this could be discrediting their opinion. It is in their interest to make sure they are not making a fool out of themselves.
Right, but so let me give you an example here. Sam has talked about the psychology of extremism for decades, right? Probably. At least if you take his first book as being, you know, broadly about that topic. But, and he had famously had a disagreement with Scott Atran, the anthropologist. And I brought it up the first time I talked to him, and the second time. And any time that Sam talks about that topic, he references, you know, Scott Atran. Mm-hmm. And that one conversation. Now, Sam has literally had decades in that area. I don't get the impression that he has read any of the literature about, like research on the psychology of extremism, except for, you know, like a Graham Wood's article in The Atlantic or something like that.
Who is very IDW-esque himself.
Yeah, but I mean, even then, that's a journalist, right? It's not a researcher. And but right. To me, it would be absolutely insane to have dedicated yourself to a topic over multiple decades and not at least even just so you can refute it. Know the literature, right? So that you can say, well, but look, because I could name people that absolutely deny roles of ideology, right? That are not Scott Adrian or downplay it. But Sam doesn't know those people. And to me, that is kind of hard to fathom that somebody would not have looked into that topic if they were interested in it in so long. Or for that matter, if you wanted to talk about immigration and the threat posed by Muslim immigration to Europe, that you wouldn't have looked into the actual migration rates and actual, you know, demographic projections.
Yeah, but what happens when you look at this stuff? It's all too woke. So you have to discredit it.
Yeah.
The immigration rates, too woke. The extremism experts, too woke. So the only person you can rely on and trust Douglas is yourself. Murray. Or Douglas Murray. Yeah, sure, yeah.
Douglas Murray and yourself. But, but don't Tommy you think, Robinson. Ina, that is slightly... So, you know, when... I do agree that there's a strategic blindness towards, you know, what Douglas Murray's output is on, like, far-right issues or in Eastern Europe or whatever the case might be. But I also do think there is a surprising, like, whenever you said, have you not listened to, you know, Dave Rubin's content or blah, 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 I think the answer is no. Like, he honestly hasn't, and whenever... he interviewed Matt and Alina. Had he not listened to like an episode of This Week in Virology with the relevant experts talking about it, I think the answer is no, which is like it is astounding, but I do think it is the case. And yeah, so that.
But how is that an excuse? That's just making him worse.
Yeah. So it's a different explanation. Than,
oh, so you're saying it's not lying. It's not I'm pretending. It's
laziness. Like,
I don't know if I buy that every single time. Perhaps.
No, not every single time. But I think it definitely is the case in a bunch of times. Like when Sam said that he hadn't listen to any of Stefan Molyneux's content at some point, right? Like when he talked about him about two or three times. I think he literally hadn't. Like he hadn't spent...
I don't know, because he's willing to put his neck out there and defend him and say he's not a Holocaust denier and say that it wasn't his legal threats that he removed the content because of... and he was actually Sam's one of his most requested guests at one point.
Yes, he did say that.
So that just feeds the narcissism. Like, oh, all my audience likes him. Maybe I should look into him. The fact, so he does this for everything. I once had Robert Spencer on my show a long time ago. I have since learned not to have bigoted assholes on my show, but. You know, I was a debatey new atheist back then, and I didn't... So my purpose for doing that, in an ideal world, I would still back that. So it was like, well, look, I'm an ex-Muslim. I'm not attached to Islam in any way whatsoever. Yet, I think that the way that you go about criticizing Islam is extremely bigoted. That's also why I've talked to Tommy Robinson before. It was only to highlight that their bigotry is apparent even to someone who does not care about Islam. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Anyways, that Robert Spencer episode. So Sam heard that. And, you know, we had an exchange after that. We had a conversation where he went about defending Robert just in the most frustrating way. Like, he kept saying, I'm not too familiar with Robert Spencer. Now, everybody knows Robert Spencer is a fucking deranged bigot. Like, he's crazy sounding to the point that other actual Islamophobes call him an Islamophobe.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It's no mystery. Just need to hear him talk for like 5 minutes. Sam yes. listened to my whole, I don't know, was it an hour, 2 hour long conversation with Robert where he accused Obama of being a secret Muslim. He argued with me about how Muslims should not be allowed to hold office because they would be swearing allegiance on the Quran and that just can't happen. I'm fuzzy on the details because it was so long ago, but it was unhinged stuff like that. He talked about the Pollywood conspiracy theory. He denied the Srebrenica genocide and all of that. So in mine and Sam's exchange, there was so much like, you know, I don't think anything he said was problematic. I don't think anything he said was bigoted. And then in the future, like, I think I did a pretty good job at extracting those views from Robert Spencer in that conversation.
Yes.
So it's pretty clear. Sam still defended them. And then in the future, I heard him talk to, I think, Majid about Robert Spencer. And again, he went on with this, oh, I don't know enough about him. So, you know, so I know he knows at that point, right? Because we've had a whole exchange about it. And he's defended some of the most unhinged things.
Yeah.
And yet I hear him do a public podcast where he's claiming he does not know enough about Robert Spencer.
Yeah. So I do agree that there is strategic, like stated ignorance, which is not true. There are examples of that. And I guess the only thing I'm saying is carve out another space for like surprising lack of rigor. Because I think that also does exist.
Sure.
Like, but I absolutely agree that so just my own example, I have informed Sam via email about a whole bunch of things that Brett and Eric have said, right? Crazy stuff, stuff. Just because in response to something he said, I don't really know what they've said, so I give him. No, a short summary.
Oh, I did that with him about Stefan Molyneux as well, actually.
Yeah.
And so yeah.
In that case, it feels like there shouldn't be the possibility in the future, at least to say to me, well, I didn't know anything about that. But I feel like I would get that response, right? Like I haven't tracked their output and that kind of thing. So yeah, that I do agree that also happens, but I think like one of the things is it's partly because of that conversation that I had with Sam recently where I genuinely don't think he has read any of the research on extremism.
Okay, sure. Sometimes he might be extremely lazy and other times he's deceptive. So
yeah, and I don't know that this is actually better for him in any respect, but I think it could be laziness. I do think laziness comes into it in terms of like not doing research, but I also think part of it is confidence that
he's
correct. So he doesn't, you know, what would be the point to listen to a bunch of, like you said, woke academics doing apologetics for extremists. He already, you know, knows what they're going to say, so he doesn't need to check. That is the impression that I also get. And in our conversation with Sam, he did that a whole bunch of times directly with us, where he's like, I know where you're going to go with this. Here's what, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's not where we were going to go with it, or at least it's, you know, like tangential to what we wanted to say. So yeah, very, very, very high levels of confidence might be the way to put it as well.
That's the nicest possible way one could put that. Okay, so, sure. Sure, Chris.
Three buckets. Ignorance, genuine ignorance, strategic ignorance, and overconfidence. I don't think that fits a particularly good picture in competition.
I mean, I would use different words to describe those things, but sure. Yeah, I would be like lying, deceptiveness.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to support it, there are several ways you can do that. You can share it online, talk about what you just heard. You can leave a 5-star review to help others find it too. And you can also subscribe via patreon.com/nicemangoes. No E in mangoes. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter before it's completely wrecked, you'll find me at nicemangoes. Again, no E in mangoes.